Well, thank you for being with us today on a special edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and we're here at the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California, with our guest, and I'm very pleased to be able to have her as our guest today, Laura Whitehorn. Laura, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for coming all the way up here to have me be with you.
Well, it's something that I've been wanting to do for a while. By the way, just on a personal side, how's your shoulder?
Oh, much better, thank you. It just takes, you know, like us old NBA players, when we start to retire, it takes longer and longer.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. I've had a little bit of a back injury just lately, but we won't get into that. To the best of my mathematical prowess as I was coming down here today, as far as I can tell, you've been incarcerated for something like 11 years.
Yeah, a little over. 11 years last May.
11 years last May. Why is that?
Well, I was arrested in 1985 on May 11th, along with Marilyn Buck and Linda Evans, although we were in different cities. And we were arrested for engaging in a long series of armed activities against the U.S. government. And some of them weren't armed, some of them were just political, just straight political without the arms. But basically with resistance, acts of resistance against the United States government. In solidarity with national liberation struggles inside this country, specifically the New African or Black liberation struggle, the Mexicano struggle, and the Puerto Rican struggle, and the Native American struggle, and also around the world from South Africa to Palestine and Central America. And we were all charged immediately with possession of weapons and charges like that, and later in 1988 we were charged along with Alan Berkman and Tim Blunk and Susan Rosenberg with a conspiracy to resist the United States government.
Yes, that's, I guess I was reading about that, the so-called resistance conspiracy case.
Yeah,
could you talk a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, there's so many issues with you that I hope we can cover. I know that you're a new author for the Prison Legal News,
I believe. Right.
I read your column.
Kicking and screaming.
Yes, I read your column. But talk, if you will, about the resistance conspiracy case, and also, of course, you were held in preventative detention for several years prior to that as well.
Yeah.
Can you talk about all of that so people can get an idea about what was happening around all that?
Sure. Let me get the preventive detention thing out of the way first, because when I was held in preventive detention, which meant no bail, it was big news, because at that point in the early 80s, there was a right to bail in this country. And unless you had committed the most heinous crime and had billions of dollars so that there was no way of ensuring that you wouldn't flee, you got bail. And you were permitted to pay bail and get out and prepare for trial. But starting right the year before we were arrested with a case of Black revolutionaries in New York, the government, there was a congressional move and the Supreme Court went along with it. And they instituted something called preventive detention, which means that on the flimsiest of allegations, you can be held without bail. When I was first in preventive detention, I was one of the few. By 4 years later, when I was still being held in preventive detention and had not yet gone to trial, it was par for the course. And it is now par for the course. No, very few people get bail anymore, if, especially the ones who are too poor to pay it. In Washington, D.C., about half of the jail was being held on preventive detention.
So let me ask you this, because I just want to clarify that. Are you saying that you were held incarcerated 4 years prior to even going to trial?
Well, I had a mistrial. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a few little things that happened, and then they declared me in contempt of court because I wouldn't give handwriting sample to the FBI and stuff like that, and they charged me with a small case for a passport violation. But every time I would finish whatever little sentence it was, I would go back into preventive detention. So all together, I've lost track. I think I spent 4 years and a couple of months strictly being held without bail.
And at that time, this was something that was really rare, and now what you're seeing from being inside the system is it's becoming commonplace.
Yeah, there used to be, I mean, when I was first arrested, there was a Fourth Amendment, and one of the reasons I had a mistrial was because there was an illegal search of the house that we'd been living in, blatantly illegal, easy to prove. The FBI agents on the stand told us themselves without meaning to, And by the time that case got all the way to the Supreme Court, the Fourth Amendment was something in the past. So it didn't matter anymore if the police searched your house without just cause. If they didn't mean to break the law, quote unquote, then it was all right.
And they, at the time, if I remember what I read correctly, were basically searching for other people and
they
came
were,
to your
they
place.
They were searching for whatever they would find.
They
basically.
Were searching for anybody and everybody.
And
when,
if the judge said, "Were you searching for fugitives?" they'd say, "Oh yes." If he said, "Were you looking for a bomb?" they'd say, "Oh yes, that we were looking for that." They were just looking. Mm-hmm. They thought no one was in the house. They got a pass key. It didn't work, so they broke down the door. And the thing I think is significant about the preventive detention thing is two things. One is it was first used against people that the government could call terrorists. Now, this was in a period when we were coming out of the Reagan administration, the Contra scandal, Iran-Contra. It was so easy to look at what the government was doing and saying, well, that's illegal, it's immoral, they're lying, they're cheating, all that kind of stuff. But no one would call them terrorists because they had state power, whereas if people were fighting back, and whether it was the ANC in South Africa, which of course is now part of the government, that used to be a terrorist organization in the United States lexicon. And the first people who were held in preventive detention were called terrorists. Of course, they were later acquitted of all charges against them. So, you know, it was a political move, and it presaged the use of preventive detention against greater and greater segments of the people. So I would just say that whenever the left is being called names, people should be very careful what's going on underneath. The second thing is that they were able to hold me in preventive detention despite the fact that I had a father who was willing to bail me out, very little of an arrest record. My arrest record is all from the 60s, and it was probably the judge's kids probably had the same arrest records that I did, was because I was a revolutionary. And they actually quoted at one point, the judge said, because you've said, by your own words, you've said you live by revolutionary and human principles. And for that reason, I consider you a flight risk. And I thought that was pretty funny because I said, well, judge, if you don't believe in human principles, what do you believe in? So it was part of what I think is going on to this day, which is a way of denying that there are political prisoners by calling us other things, whether it's criminals or terrorists or whatever. The United States is able to cover over the fact that there are political prisoners by scaring the public with things like preventive detention, they're so dangerous they can't be let out, with hugely long sentences, and with control of the media, thank goodness for people like you, so that people on the street don't hear that there are political prisoners.
What, in the end, did the government manage to sentence you to?
Altogether 23 years. That was I was lucky. Even though the Fourth Amendment was done away with, fighting about the suppression of evidence for so long, kind of, you know, cases cool off. So Baltimore had forgotten who I was, even though in 85 I was a hot property. By 89 or 90, it was new district attorney, U.S. attorney, they didn't remember anymore. I was the lucky one. My co-defendants are doing, well, Susan Rosenberg's got 58 years, Linda Evans has 40 years, Marilyn Buck has 80 years. And as you know from interviewing Mutulu Shakur, he's got a hefty sentence too. Most political prisoners and POWs have longer sentences than I do. And that's kind of sad when I can say I only have 23 years and I'm only going to serve 14 and then I'm going to be out.
Only 23
right,
years.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're here at FCI Dublin talking with political prisoner Laura Whitehorn, and we'll be back in just a few moments. We're back talking with Laura Whitehorn here at FCI Dublin, political prisoner and activist, even though being held here at Dublin.
Well, that's true.
Talk, if you will, about the resistance conspiracy case.
That was a case that was brought against seven of us, seven anti-imperialists, all of whom had very long good records, people's records of struggle in the anti-war movement, at Wounded Knee, in support of the Native American sovereignty movement, certainly in support of the Black liberation struggle, from the Civil Rights Movement to Black Power and the Black Panthers, et cetera. And the actions that we were charged with were a series of bombings in which no one was hurt against government buildings from the U.S. Capitol, which was the one that they were that the government made the most of, to the New York Police Benevolent Association office, which is kind of the spokespiece for the white supremacist use of the police in New York against black people. And all of these actions were carried out as part of movements on the street who were protesting U.S. policies, especially in Central America in that time period. In Grenada, the bombing of the Capitol followed the U.S. intervention in and murder of hundreds of citizens of Grenada and overthrow of their government. And there were a number of actions that were taken in solidarity with the people of Nicaragua and El Salvador and Puerto Rico. And the charges were very complicated because the way they constructed the indictment was so that even if they couldn't prove who did any of the actions, which they couldn't, to this day they don't really know that any of us did them or didn't, but they wrote the indictment in such a way that they had it all covered, aiding and abetting, being in sympathy with it, it just covered a lot of ground. And so we saw it as a kind of indictment that was dangerous for the left if it were able to be brought to court and successfully tried. Now, we took a plea in that case. Three of us, Marilyn Buck, Linda Evans, and I, decided after we had been there for 3 years fighting the case to plead guilty to some of the charges so that the charges would be thrown out against the other three. And the main reason for that was that Alan Berkman was at that point dying of Hodgkin's disease. He'd had it twice since we'd been... He was arrested in 1985 also. He had had Hodgkin's disease and had radiation and chemotherapy. Once he had it again, we were in D.C. jail. He was in a locked ward in D.C. General Hospital. He was on death's doorstep several times. He was paralyzed from the waist down, and he desperately needed to get to a decent medical facility. And so we pleaded guilty because it would have been another 3 years that we were there, and he probably would have died. So we thought at that point that it was worth not going through the trial for him so that he could live, and he is now alive and doing well, doing AIDS medical work on the street in New York. He got out because the charges were dismissed against him. He got out a couple of years later when he completed his underlying case, which was for possession of guns, what I was talking about before, the things we were arrested for.
And also for providing medical treatment to Marilyn Buck as well.
Right, that's the other thing. I know I always forget about that one because it's so ridiculous.
Well, it certainly would seem to be. Right. It's really interesting. I don't know how much you know about a San Jose Mercury News piece that was just printed, a three-part story about how the CIA and the Contras were flooding South Central Los Angeles with crack cocaine. So.
Oh, well, we've known that for a long time.
Many people have known that, but now it's in a mainstream newspaper, and even Senator Feinstein is calling for an investigation into the CIA.
You know, we saw the movie Panther here last year, which was a very good movie, and a lot of the younger women talked to those of us who had been around during those days, and it was amazing to talk to people who are seeing and living the destruction of their communities through crack, and to describe to them what we saw with our own eyes in the 60s at the end of the era of the Black Panthers, when I actually watched in Brooklyn, New York, watched at night and saw a cop car dropping kids off, who, you know, 12-year-old kids from the neighborhood, who the next week would come out wearing a lot of gold jewelry and, you know, a lot of pocket cash, and who had obviously been working with the police to spread drugs in the neighborhood. And you can tell people that when it's documented by the news media, it has a lot more clout to it. People will listen.
Well, certainly Dr. Shakur was telling me a very, very long story about that about a year ago in Florence, Colorado.
Oh, yes.
He's quite knowledgeable about it.
Well, he fought the drug plague from the inside, from the inside, not of prison, but the inside of the community for many, many years, and used acupuncture to try to cure drug addiction. And, of course, the Black Liberation Army for many years campaigned against drug dealers, and some people are now doing life in prison for having campaigned against drug dealers. It's kind of ironic that they're in cells right next to guys who are locked up for dealing drugs, so if you're not the government, you don't get away with it, I guess, is the message.
Who is Laura Whitehorn, and how does she get to have become the person that she is?
I'm a kid who grew up in the 50s and the 60s in New York, like thousands and thousands of other kids. There are probably many people with different names but very similar backgrounds and similar thoughts and feelings, because when I was growing up, I saw around me, well, it was the McCarthy era, so there was a lot of repression when I was a kid, and if you said anything unusual in school, you were called a communist, which I was called in the sixth grade when I didn't even know what it meant. But the main thing that I saw was segregation, because even in New York, we had segregation. The public schools were segregated. And I knew for myself that there was no difference between black people and white people, and yet the conditions of life were so different, and there was no logical explanation for it. And it ate away at me when I was a kid. It just bothered me. And when the Civil Rights Movement came along, I joined in any way I could, because I couldn't stand the thought that I was living in a system that where I was getting privileges because of the color of my skin. And as a Jew, I knew that those privileges could be taken away at any moment, because it doesn't matter who you are. If the government wants to institute a system, or thinks it's profitable, or for social control wants to quiet one group, whether it's lesbians, I'm a lesbian, I can get, you know, slapped around for that, or Jews, or whatever it is. But the main thing going on in this country always has been racism. And I don't know, I guess it never seemed to go away, so I never stopped struggling. And when the 60s came along, for the first time, I understood that there was a way to fight and change something. You know, racism wasn't just some bad guys with bad ideas. You know, I couldn't understand why it had been around for so long and no one had noticed, because when I was a kid, I thought, well, it's not fair, therefore it should be changed. And once I understood it was a system, I knew you had to fight it. But once I saw that people in Vietnam were fighting and winning their independence, and people in Africa and Latin America were fighting and winning their independence, understood how Cuba had won, I began to understand that there could actually be change, but it was going to take a lot of struggle, a lot of fighting, and a lot of being willing to die. And I've seen a lot of people die in the course of this struggle, in this country as well as around the world. I haven't given up hope. I mean, I know things out there, all my friends who are leftists say, oh, you wouldn't recognize it, you know, no one wants to do anything, but I don't believe it. I just think, you know, we're in a quiet period. It's happened before. And I think the way things are going, things getting so much worse, it's not going to last that long.
Well, it certainly doesn't seem to be headed for much more. Things are going actually pretty badly out there.
Oh, right. I mean, the welfare, mm-hmm. the abolition of welfare. It's just my parents, who are both dead now, were dyed-in-the-wool Roosevelt Democrats. They were New Dealers. They had been socialists when they were younger, but, you know, they thought capitalism was going to be progressive. And welfare and Social Security were the two things that they would always throw at me to say, why do you have to change the society? Look, we've got, you know, we have something. And it's all going now, and going under a Democratic administration. Of course, that's always who does it.
Well, it's certainly debatable as to whether or not Bill Clinton is a Democrat.
Right, that's
or not.
True.
Do you remember why you were called a communist in the sixth grade?
It was stupid. It was because there was a song that we sang that was, I love the United States of America. I love the way we all live without fear, and I love how free we all are. And this was, I was in the sixth grade. There was a struggle in the city I lived in, New Rochelle, right outside of New York, about segregation of the elementary schools. Elementary schools. I mean, what's the point? You segregate, you put black kids in one school and white kids in another, and they're going to grow up racist. It's just, the white kids are. The black kids are going to grow up without an education because all the money is going to go to the white schools. Even in sixth grade, I understood that. So I had been trying to get that changed. I'd been signing little petitions. I mean, you know, little pipsqueak signing petitions. And when we went to sing that song, I said to my friend, I hate this song. I don't believe this song. And the music teacher heard me and said, well, that's because you're a communist. And I went home and I said to my mother, what's a communist? And she said, oh my God, has Senator McCarthy been in your class today? Because that was the tenor of the times. Mm.
Talking about the tenor of the times, you talked about the Civil Rights Movement. What about the 70s and the 80s for you?
Well, let's see. In the 70s, I was doing a lot of international solidarity, especially with Zimbabwe. And I was also doing work with Dr. Shakur against COINTELPRO, because it was at that point, coming out of the 60s, a lot of people, a lot of us, suspected that the government had destroyed the Black Panthers, but we couldn't prove it, but we always thought it. You know, we thought they were bugging our phones. We thought that, and people would tell us we were paranoid. And then, little by little, as the truth started to come out, we wanted to make it more public. And also, we wanted to help. There were political prisoners already in prison. I mean, Geronimo Pratt was in prison, and Sundiata Shakur was in prison, and Assata Shakur was in prison at that time. And we wanted to show that COINTELPRO, that the government had had a program to destroy the Black liberation struggle, because we felt that if people understood that, first of all, they would know why the charges had been thrown at people. I mean, Assata had been acquitted of every single bank robbery they had charged her with, and yet she was their prime prisoner, prime political prisoner in the country. And we wanted people to understand also for two reasons. One is that I think that it was very demoralizing for the left, and particularly for the Black movement, to think that we couldn't hold anything together. You know, here we had the Black Panther Party, here we had, you know, the students against the war and this and that, and it all self-destructed, was how it seemed. Well, if you find out that all those little inner fights that happened were fomented by informants and agents and letters that came from the government, then it explains something. Or if you know that the reason that the funds that were collected for something, you know, that we all trusted the treasurer with, were lost and embezzled, wasn't because the treasurer worked for the government. It just put a different analysis on things. And so that was one reason. And the other was that we really felt that if we could show people what the government was doing, then they would understand, people would understand why they shouldn't convict people like Geronimo Pratt. To some extent, it did get the word out, and Mutulu and Afeni Shakur worked really hard to educate people about COINTELPRO. But of course, we know it never stopped. You know, so the government settled each case, and I know that Daruba Bin Wanhad in New York was offered a settlement, I believe, by the New York Red Squad, and I think he turned it down because he doesn't want money. He wants to get the information so that we all know what was happening to us.
Well, I know the New African Liberation Front and Herman Ferguson and others are right now attempting to lean on the Congressional Black Caucus to get them to reopen the church hearings that concluded that all of the things that you said were true.
Were true, exactly.
But all of you still remain in prison, which is something that people seem to not quite be willing to address.
Yeah, which is why I think if we can't get Geronimo Pratt out of prison, then every political prisoner in POW is going to die in prison, because his case is the most obvious. I mean, they have all the facts. They know he wasn't there, and yet he still sits in prison after all these years. And so I think it's very, very important for people to find out about it. And Daruba is the one person who has been able to win his release by exposing COINTELPRO, but there are many, many more. There's Eddie Conway in Baltimore, who I knew about when I was in Baltimore City Jail, who's an ex-Panther who was framed and railroaded and has been fighting his case all this time with no victory in sight.
I asked Marilyn this question, and I'll ask you the same question. In the 60s and the 70s, and you know, not necessarily talking so much about the struggle of Black people by Black people, there were many thousands, hundreds of thousands of white people who protested against the war in Vietnam, and you know, joined in to some degree in solidarity with Blacks and civil rights and all of that. And there came a point where most of them went home.
Right.
And people such as yourself and Marilyn and others, you didn't. What's the difference?
I wish I knew, because then we'd get them back. Well, all I can say is that since I've been in prison, I've had to look to do time in prison, especially in some of the hard time I've done, solitary confinement for a long time, stuff like that, you have to look inside yourself and see, what do I really want out of life, and is this worth it? And I think that probably that's what you have to do to keep struggling, to keep being an activist too, because it can get pretty tiring and painful to be concentrating and spending your time and energy, and you know, you end up, all you have to eat that night is oatmeal instead of, you know, going out and having a job and getting some money together. And I think it has to be very deep. And I think that in this country, it's very easy to be bought off, not, you know, bribes exactly, but culturally, by the comfort, by the hope that there will be democracy, that maybe the next president. I think the reason so many leftists voted for Clinton is because, and I would love it too, if there would be a president who would come in and actually change things and change the system and take it away from the corporations and, you know, institute worker control, I would be the first in line to vote, and I would say, okay, you know, that's it. But and it would be very nice. I mean, who doesn't long for that? But until there is such a thing, which I think will never happen, I feel like I have to keep struggling. I think for some of the people who seem to have faded into the woodwork, they didn't really. Maybe they're running a health clinic or working at a health clinic. I mean, I've met, since I've been in prison, I've met people who were in the Lawyers Guild when it was founded. Okay, they were law students in the 60s or 70s, and they said, you know, we're going to be progressive lawyers. But a lot of those people now are working with big law firms or something. Some of them are still doing prisoners' rights litigation and making just enough to get by. They're still there. They're still working. And they're making a big difference in people's lives. So I think some of the people have gone back. And I think for a lot of white kids in those days, the reason why they were interested in fighting was because they didn't want to go to Vietnam and fight. So it touched them. And that's a perfectly legitimate reason to me. I have nothing, I'm not saying that that's not a good reason to be out in the street protesting a war. But that only takes you to 1975, when the Vietnamese won, the war was over, you didn't have to go anymore. And then, you know, the other things, you might sign a petition now and then, but you wouldn't necessarily be out in the street fighting. So I feel, though, that the culture that people have been able to fit into, you know, alternative culture or whatever, you know, is not going to sustain them for that long. And I think that especially with the abolition of welfare, with all the attacks on immigrants, with the worsening conditions of life for third world people in this country, I think that a lot of those people are going to start wanting to say something again.
We're here at FCI Dublin having a conversation with Laura Whitehorn, and we'll be back in just a few moments. We're back, continuing our conversation with Laura Whitehorn. I'm finding it tremendously interesting, and I hope that you are too. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and of course this is Full Logic Reverse. Laura, one of the things that I was reading in a book called Cages of Steel, which is really primarily where I began to find out a lot about yourself, Dr. Shakur, Marilyn Buck, and others, of course, is that there seems to be a real disparity in the way leftists that the government decides are quote-unquote terrorists and rightists that the government decides are quote-unquote terrorists are prosecuted and sentenced. In particular, I'm thinking about, was his name Don Black, who was going to invade Haiti or wherever, and seems like they don't quite do as much time as you folks do.
No, in fact, some of them did less time in prison than I did on preventive detention. But I think, you know, I actually think that's changing now, because I think the right wing has become so actually terrorist. I mean, there is such a thing as terrorism, right? And the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma, to me, was a terrorist act. I mean, I watched on TV as the rescue squads carried small children out of, you know, dead bodies of children out of that building. I think that in some cases the right wing has gone too far for the government, which usually just, you know, loves it to death. Even so, they don't do the same numbers on them. You know, they did a lot of human interest stories that made their way into the pages of the Washington Post, whereas each of us had the experience when we were first arrested of having some reporter from a mainstream newspaper come to see us, write a long, in-depth interview, only to have it rejected by the editor, without wanting to specify the reasons sometimes. So anything that was really sympathetic to us and portrayed us as human beings wasn't permitted in the mainstream press, whereas you get all these, long pieces on Timothy McVeigh and all those guys. But I do think that they're going to get more time because they've overstepped the bounds, it exposes the government, they can't quite say, oh, this is okay, and people were so horrified by that. So I think it is changing.
Do you think it's a matter of that at the time that, the so-called left was, in so-called revolutionary period and all of that, that the status quo, the government, corporations, saw you folks as a real threat and you had to be eliminated.
Yeah.
And that now, with the rise of the militias and the way they're beginning to challenge the government, certainly from maybe a different perspective and with a different agenda, nevertheless, they're putting a lot of pressure on the powers that be now. And so now the focus has shifted. Now we need to deal very harshly with them.
Yeah, although I don't think it's ever going to be quite the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really don't, because I don't think that fundamentally what we threaten is not just the status quo and law and order, but the whole basis of the system. We're saying capitalism promotes individualism, promotes greed, and it doesn't have to be that way. And they're holding on to their purses and saying, well, it is this way. And the right wing is just saying, I want my share, and I want to be the one to decide it. And what the right wing and the government have in common is white supremacy. The government isn't standing up there like it used to and making blatantly racist remarks. But in terms of power, they want to control the power. They don't want black folks controlling the power. They want white folks controlling the power. And a few third world people are allowed in, but mostly it's a white supremacist system. And the right wing is completely all right with that. They want a white supremacist system too. And they're not challenging capitalism. They just want states' rights capitalism as opposed to federal capitalism. So I really think that even though those individuals will get harsher sentences than the Klansmen did, who were Don Black, you mentioned, and Michael Bray, who bombed, I think, 10 or 7 abortion clinics, and he actually served, I think, 4 years. There was a woman in Mariana when I was there, who had bombed 10 abortion clinics. And so that means that she bombed clinics when people were there and people were injured or were in danger of being injured. We were convicted, we were pled to a series of four bombings, and there were four others that were sort of in the conspiracy, and no one was ever hurt. She got 10 years total, and I got 23, and I got the most time in that case, but only because other people had more time, but the comparison is pretty stark. Now I think those guys will get more time, but only as individuals. Their movements won't be investigated in the same way. I mean, look at Weaver in Idaho. If any of the black people whose homes have been invaded move, they finally got a little bit of money from the city of Philadelphia for the fire bombing of their house by the city and killing all those 11 women, children, and men. But Weaver got his day in the national press, I think he got paid for it, I'm not sure. He got vindication. None of the black people who have been killed by the police in raids has ever gotten that kind of thing. Look at what it took to get Fred Hampton, who was the chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party and was killed in his bed, and it was in 1969, and it was proven definitively to be a government attack engineered by J. Edgar Hoover and carried out by the Illinois State Attorney's Office. It took years and years of trying to wring some money out by his family to get a little bit of something.
I remember that case well. That's the neighborhood I grew up in.
Chicago. Oh, really?
Yes. It's interesting that you brought up MOVE, and just for a piece of topical information as well, course, a federal judge, Judge Pollack, has now rescinded the judgment that the former police and fire commissioners were to pay Ramona Africa a dollar a week or whatever it was, and now he has said that they don't have to do that. So I know that, people involved with MOVE and MUMIA and others are quite angry about this latest turn of events.
But they still get money from the city, right?
They still get some. I don't know quite how much it is, but there was a judgment that was entered into that said, you know, you will pay her $1 a week for 11 years.
It's
kind
of
a punishment thing.
Yeah. Well, but it was finally, there was some admission, you know, that there was wrongdoing on the part of the city government. But and Ramona Africa will never get those 7 years back that she spent in prison for the terrible crime of surviving the firebombing.
And refusing to disassociate herself from MOVE and from the teachings of John Africa as well.
See, there's another example of what I'm saying. I think that MOVE, I remember when I first became aware of MOVE, what I was aware of was that they were a community project. They were doing squatting and housing. They were trying to develop a different kind of a lifestyle in the midst of urban America. And they were black. And I remember thinking at the time, they're not going to last long. They're going to be attacked. And sure enough, they were attacked over and over by the city government and the police. And if they were some white hippies, I mean, look at Waco. They massacred people, the government did, but they gave them months before they did that. If that had been MOVE, they would have been dead in a day. Because it was black and white, but also because of the politics. You know, the Waco people were kind of a right-wing cult. And MOVE is definitely has some socialist philosophy in there, in the Africa doctrine, the doctrine of John Africa. And so I think that that's what's also challenging, even though ideas by themselves don't challenge anything. I think that when people put action together with ideas, then you're going to be singled out in some way.
What I just heard you say is that in the final analysis, it all comes down to race and economics. And if you are
an ideology,
and I guess primarily, I mean, I guess if you are white and you're going to go for the capitalist system, then you're going to be okay.
Right.
And if you're black and if you even start sounding like a socialist, you're in trouble.
Right. And I will say this about even the resistance conspiracy case and even the time that we got and even how they treated us there. If we had been black, we would have gotten it much worse. I knew that at every point. When I was arrested, I resisted because I was just in this house, and these FBI cops broke in, threw me to the floor, and stood on me. And then they said, come on, and I wouldn't come on, you know, so we had a little tussle. And I knew, I was aware in my mind the whole time, if I were black, I'd be beaten, whatever it was, I knew it at every point. And, you know, you can't prove that, but I don't. If I say that to any of my friends inside, whether it's in D.C. jail or Baltimore City jail or here, they're going to know what I'm talking about. And in court, we were treated as very dangerous people. There was a bulletproof shield put up and all that kind of stuff. But we always were aware that we still were white, even though, and, you know, they hate us with a certain, like, I think the government hates Marilyn Buck with a passion because they consider her a race traitor. They consider all of us race traitors, but because of the charges that they got her on of acting in solidarity with the BLA and as part of the BLA, they consider her a race traitor, and they don't understand that she and we are trying to be the best that we can, and not, you know, to destroy a race, but to destroy racism. Because if white people stop looking at ourselves as white, that's the first step. If we look at ourselves as humans and not as white people, and therefore entitled to certain privileges and, you know, representing Western civilization and blah, blah, then that's a first step towards eradicating at least the thinking behind racism, if not the practice of it.
Right, and the government attempted to label her as, quote, the sole white member of the Black Liberation Army.